Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Software Crafts Podcast. I'm your host, João, and today with me I have Mikola. Mikola is a software engineer, working at Bol.com since 2015. He's mostly within what's so-called featured delivery teams, with logisticals and supply chain, the hidden part of an e-commerce company, with occasional detours towards platform development. He's a proponent, an adopter, of rapid feedback techniques in software development. Throughout functional testing in development, progress, feature delivery and trunk-based development, or testing in production, shadow and live. On the technical side, he's a believer in microservices, preference for higher tier testing as opposed to heavy use of mocks. Welcome, Mikola. How are you?
Hi. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm very glad to be on your podcast.
Thanks for your time. And deep diving to the heuristic of today, it's a very broad one. Diagnose before cure. What is your opinion about that?
Yeah, I think it's quite an important one. And it's rightfully, shall I reread this this diagnostic? Oh, it will be probably in the resources. So we're talking about that before solving a problem, it's good to measure the beginning state and measure the state after we solve the problem to make sure that we have solved the problem, especially if it's about the non-functional requirements like performance tuning an application. And my first reaction when I was reading through this this heuristic was, well, it's not only about performance and non-functional, it's also about functional not only technical. I've seen this often also with the business. They have the hypothesis that some feature will change some behavior or improve some process, and we all always want to measure that it does indeed deliver what we wanted. But yes, it's an important heuristic, and it's easy to forget, especially if you have preferences and you think that something will be solved by your small changes.
Very interesting. So you were talking about preferences. So let's start there.
Yeah.
Do you think that we as software engineers, our preferences gets on the way when we are diagnosing?
Yes, I think it's natural for human beings, I think, to have preferences and then start to do selective listening, selective interpretation of the facts to push towards the preferences. But especially in the software engineering, we have do we go functional style or more object-oriented style? Do we do DDD or some other way of implementation? And those are all good techniques and can be applied either separately or in combinations, but sometimes these techniques can obscure the actual problem that we're trying to solve. And that I saw a couple of times when people are too much focused on the technical implementation and they miss what behind the trees of the technical implementation, they miss the actual business need or business requirement. And then what is even more dangerous when these trees of our preference start to influence our discussion with the stakeholder, with domain experts, and add this accidental complexity of our choices into the overall discussion. Sometimes it's good to have a feedback from the technical side because everything is interrelated. But we should be careful. But when we're imposing something because of our choices in the implementation, and when something is essential to the domain.
Very, very interesting. So you talk about lots of let's call scenes that goes around our industry. And I think that we learn by our experience.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn in your career when you talk with stakeholders and when you need to balance between a talk about technical details and forget about technical details and then move to business requirements or the purpose? Why are we creating software? What did you learn? What are the techniques that you use? I think that the audience is very interested in your experience there.
I think the most important technique that I use is empathy towards the domain experts. So put away your preference, your implementation detail, especially at the beginning when you're trying to understand, and listen to their story. And later, maybe you will add your technical details. Okay, it's might be good the way you are saying, but we have already different implementation, so we need somehow to fit. How we bridge that? Are we moving together in your vision, or we need to find some common space? Yes, and that's what I also see in some teams and some people. They can be very strong technically, but they build their own model, and then they feed what the input they get from the domain experts, from the stakeholders, into that model, and maybe not adapting enough the model, not too critical about the model, because it's always good to have a model, but it's about how you work with it later. And to give instantly also even a slightly different example, sometimes we have to rely on our model because the input that we're getting is not consistent, or we cannot understand altogether, and we still need to build something. And we cannot build as technical people, as engineers, something for a model that we don't understand. So sometimes when this bridge is not strong enough, we build something with the way we see the model, and maybe in my experience, usually at the end of the project, I start to understand what actually the business people wanted from me. They could not express in the ways we could understand each other. And maybe if I were doing it from the beginning, I would start the way they were saying.
That's true. And I can understand the connection about your remark with accidental complexity. And how do you, when you discover that you and the team have accidental complexity, mm-hmm. how do you revert or fight that?
Well, ideally, you want to get rid of that accidental complexity by a kind of a refactoring, especially if it starts to add a friction. If in this discussion you say, okay, now I understand what you mean, but we have this accidental complexity and this pops up all the time, that means that it's a friction point and you want to get rid of this friction point. And then you go along the normal refactoring, normal changes process. Of course, there is always a difficult question of prioritization, and that's a big problem with quick decisions, with simple decisions made earlier, which add those accidental complexities, because later it can be very difficult to get rid of them, not only because many other things already depend on them, but also because you have other priorities, you need to prioritize it. And that can be challenging, especially in the areas where there is a high level of changes, lots of demand for new features.
Can imagine that. But also you mentioned in the beginning that having hypotheses and measuring mm-hmm. stuff, mm-hmm. It's important. So when we have measures in place by metrics or KPIs, do you think mm-hmm. that the discussion about refactoring, it's easier, or you didn't feel that during your career?
Well, these measurements of friction can be difficult indeed. It's like a technical depth. It's not very easy to measure because it's an abstract thing. It's not something that you can put a very easy quantifier on that. And often these friction points, they come in often they come not in the something that's blocking. It just adds up as a long tail. So it's not very visible. So I would not be able to quickly jump into say, okay, just put KPI and it will show everything. In some cases, it might be adding if you have if those things add to instabilities, to time you need to spend on fixing things, on maybe even some money loss or whatever loss, then it's good. Then naturally you have something to show, you have something to talk into the business talk. Otherwise, it becomes a little bit more complicated because you need to talk about sustainability and you need to build up trust so that it would be understood that you're not just talking because you like to change something, but because there is something really you care about for the value for your stakeholders.
Very interesting, very interesting. And now, if you may, I'm going to switch topics. So I saw your talks about testing in production, and I can imagine the assumptions that people have, because also it's a provocative title. Mm-hmm. But let's talk more about that. What is testing in production?
Testing in production is a way to actually assess your hypothesis, either that this will be a new feature or that you have a fix, not in a simulated environment, like on your isolated test environment or in some staging environment, but in production. And the benefit of it is that you, well, whenever you're trying to test any assumption, you want to be testing it as close as possible to the reality. And the production is the closest way to reality. Although, again, when we're starting to build up the testing facilities on production, sometimes we can tweak it so the production becomes not one big crisp production, but with some deviations and so on. And we're talking now mostly about the context of Bold.com, for example, where you have an enterprise platform, and that's your production. It's not about version software. Although I will come back to the version software maybe a little bit in a second. I have a good experience recently. But the main driver for us to switch to this technique was that at Bold.com, especially, I saw it, with the switch to microservices, with this growing in scale of number of teams, feature teams, building in parallel, it became not feasible to do a very thorough testing on staging environments. And in isolation, because we're in the distributed environment, you're not getting the whole picture. So you can only test your assumptions, but you're not testing how it works together. And that's why we had to go to production.
And I also can imagine, given the size, and for the audience that is not in the Netherlands, Bold.com is the leading marketplace in the Netherlands. So think about Amazon, but on this side of the world, same type of stuff, but leading in Netherlands, also in Belgium. So with these, also I can imagine that testing on lower level environments is expensive, because trying to replicate the same traffic patterns, it's expensive, because your production infrastructure is big, right?
Yeah, the production, it's big, so it becomes not economical to, you cannot replicate it for every team and especially for every feature all the time. So you have to make a compromise if you want to go there. So you have shared environments, and then you have all the nicety of the shared environment when one team is testing something and then another team is testing something. And when you have 3, 5, maybe 10 even teams, you can kind of maybe schedule these testing areas. But if you are starting to have 20 teams, I think about 100 now or 80, then it's basically not scalable anymore. And another thing is that when you're trying to replicate the production behavior, you're replicating the things you're aware of. Again, you don't know how it will work on production, because it's with the bigger systems, it becomes not only your software, not only the software of other teams, it's also how the external parties are reacting on their changes. For 3 or 2 years, I was busy with supply chain. So we would be purchasing, sending orders to suppliers. And then your change, it also affects how the software on the side of the supplier interpret your changes. And sometimes, yes, we did everything correctly per specification, how business want to, but we need to do some interesting hacks, because apparently a big supplier has a different interpretation of our data that we just figured out after some data analysis why they are late all the time.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Also, I work with that that part, and it's very interesting how the big suppliers behave. And I think that also you are referring to mental models, right? You talk a bit about that, but it's the mental model that we have from the system versus the actual reality. But before we going there, now we have lots of branches to explore.
Yeah.
For a trunk-based development guy, punch intended. So we talk about testing in production, going back. What are the techniques that you use to test in production, right? You have, in your bio, you have two, Shadow and Live. But can you elaborate more on that for people to understand techniques that you do or you can use?
Yeah, so the two main techniques indeed, the Shadow, I think, is the most canonical for me, at least. It's when you run on same production environment your normal branch, your normal services or with feature flags, and then you stream the same data or part of the data events via the new functionality, via the new implementation. And there you can real-time compare what's the behavior. And you can even build your features, your software, this way incrementally on production and get a constant feedback. Instead of making an assumption, you can check that they are correct. I can have something in logs. I can have exception if it's completely shadow. I don't expect this to happen. Put there in if I start to see those exceptions, okay, my expectation was not correct. And also for the analysis about the behavior of a new feature, for example. And you, I'm usually working with back office applications, but in the front end, you would usually do something similar with A/B testing, for example, especially in the later phases where you have a stable feature. Usually you want to deliver stable stuff to production. And then you put some of your population to this to one of the branches A and B, which carried me a little bit away to the next case where we're testing not in the shadow but actually on production, and that means that we either do A B switches, say that for some cases we will be using the new implementation, for the majority we'll be using still the old, or we just enable it in the simplest case and see what's happening. And if it goes okay, then we're keeping it up. We're measuring this. That comes back to our heuristics at the beginning. If we see that it misbehaves, maybe it becomes even worse, the behavior of our systems, we recover from it. That depends, of course, on the case, on the on how critical the path is, whether you can recover or not. In the best situation, you have events like orders, purchases that you can replay and correct if you see that for some reason the things went not very well.
Cool. Thanks to shadow some light on the practices and techniques and what can vary between back office and front end applications. I think that the audience start to get an idea. So, and I can say or I can assume that you need mature engineering practices to adopt testing in production. We talk about observability. We talk about, or we assume that we have pipelines because we have quick feedback, small features. You talk about feature flags.
Yeah.
It's a prerequisite or not?
I think, yes. I guess because otherwise you will be, you will have too high of a risk. It's technically it's not a prerequisite because if you recall how the software was built initially, like when you had a small PHP site or something, you would just log into the server and adjust things on the fly. Maybe back in that days you didn't even have source control. And then you learn that it's better to test some things before you change it. So that's why we started to get those environments in front of them. But then when we see that as it doesn't scale, we start to say, okay, no, we want to do things to do more experimentation on production, but how we make it so that the risks are not too high, because you don't want to just hack around on the major website of the Netherlands the price of the mistake might be high enough, even if you can recover it, because the time and the cost of recovery will be high enough. So you want to already go to production with a certain level of quality. And that's another part of the equation where I was busy with, where the teams I was working with were busy, how to make sure that the software that we're building to production, that bring into production, is of the quality that, based on the assumptions that we had when we were building, it's high. So it delivers. We know how it behaves. We have these expectations, and we deliver it to production, not to check that it behaves as we think it should behave, but to make sure that within the context of the bigger picture, it works together properly, and that our assumptions, which we could not easily test otherwise, are correct. And yes, and then how to, because you are testing this on production, not on the staging environments where you have more control, or even in your development environment, you need to have a way to do the evaluations. So you need to have visibility, you need to know that something went wrong or good, especially wrong, to quickly do a corrective action. You need to be able to do quickly a corrective action to decrease the damage if something is happening, which you need to do anyway, even if you're not testing on production, just because any change delivered to production will be a disruption. But the benefit, one of the side effects, some benefits of the testing on production is that you take it as a first class. You know that you will not be relying on some staging. You will go to production and will be testing there. That's why you know that you will be using the tools and the features available there. And that's another thing that often I see, that the tools that are available on staging in many setups are different than those which will be available on production. And that means that when things go not as expected, you might have less experience of fixing them, or even not able to see them quick enough.
Very interesting to get off all of these insights and how to operate at this scale, and also how the engineering practices relate to that. When we start talking about testing in production, you talk about version software versus enterprise platforms.
Yeah.
So far, we have been talking about enterprise platforms. How about version software?
Yeah, but version software is obviously a little bit more difficult, because usually you don't have... you ship your software to your consumers and they run it. So you don't have your own production, basically, to test it. And I saw a couple of ways to work this around. My recent experience at Bold.com was that I joined platform teams, and we were building tools that help feature teams to send their data for BI analysis to BigQuery of Google Cloud platform. And we also were building tools that were checking that the data is consistent that is sent. And these tools that were... they had some flaws, and we made some criticals while delivering, especially because originally the tools were supposed to be for BI only, but eventually people are starting to use it for more and more. And then when things getting broken, we discovered that apparently it's now on the critical path. But because the price of our mistake went a little bit high, and we had non-trivial features, especially deduplication of the messages, of the data, we started to think, okay, can we somehow prevent those escalations and criticals? Because we're delivering non-trivial piece of changes. We don't know. We tested everything that we know, but how it will work with our consumers, especially in the complicated cases where we cannot just do one query and check that things are working fine. And then we started, looked and did actually the shadow run on production for our consumers. We reached out to our clients, our teams, feature teams, and said, okay, well, guys, you heard recently we had some issues. We are not happy about that, but it's difficult for us to solve it, and we'd like you to help us. Please give us access to your data sets, and we will be doing in shadow the most complicated part, the deduplication it was for our case. So we would be reading their buffers, incoming buffers, and doing in Shadow the new implementation of the JIT application, and then checking the result constantly with the actual result. And that's how we would be trying to see whether we have missed anything, because we have different configuration settings, different types of the data that is sent. A small feature, kind of simple feature, but very much complexity, combinatorial complexity. And that really gave us quite some confidence in going, and we learned a lot about how our tool is used, how we can set up our tools, and we could prove this, that our thing are working on production before we're rolling them out. And I also know that some people with version software, they do this stuff or setup with running Shadow on some of the installations. Or another option is to have a cloud version, a free maybe version, where you can, or hosted by your own, where you can do these experiments. But of course, that's a higher price. In our case, we had to limit, in our example of the platform team of bold.com, we had to limit our experimentations, our Shadow runs, to only critical moments where we knew that we expect something because of the price of the deduplication.
Very interesting story. Thanks for sharing. If the audience have similar stories, you can shout out on social media. Mm-hmm. You will add the social media websites of Mikola. So you can continue this discussion. And how about the more, let's call, traditional type of testings? What is mm-hmm. your standing there?
With the more traditional type of testing, that we mean a testing on staging environments, and in particular by dedicated testers. And there...
Yes, let's start with that scenario, yes.
So that was one of the things that I was not fighting or struggling, but more concerned about, that in feature teams at bold.com, when I joined, usually we would have a dedicated tester. And that, for me, was adding actually more, often more negative, more downsides to the team, because the developers would be, would often get this mentality of throw over the wall to the tester, and tester will figure out whether it's good or not, and our task is done here, we're continuing with the next feature. And then for with the testers also, there are many good, great testers and strong testers, but for many smaller features, especially somewhere in the back office, it's not very interesting for them. There are from the testing perspective, it's not very interesting, not that much interesting stuff maybe. And there you might get slightly less strong testers, no, still good people, but not that experienced. And then you have feature teams that might also be less experienced, less strong. And then you have this bottleneck of testing, and that I saw often coming to the bottleneck. So what we were trying to do, and we often do with feature teams now at bold.com, as far as I know, most of the time, by default, we don't have a tester. You might have a tester if you have complicated situation. If you have a monolith that is shared between many different teams, like our web shop, I think still is a little bit of a monolith. There is, I have really a need for some, for people. Also, when you have much riskier area, but by default, I think it's good to have responsibility of the team to provide, to test on the, well, to provide the quality basically.
Good one. And the next scenario is, okay, now the team provides, the people are skilled enough, you don't have dedicated people to tasks, because testing, in my opinion, is a task, not, you know, it's part of the workflow, like deploy mm-hmm. or gather mm-hmm. requirements or do design, mm-hmm. right? We start to blend in and we have skills. So let's say that we have this team without dedicated people for testing, but we still do unit testing and we still do lots mm-hmm. of acceptance testing. What is your stand with these testing practices itself?
Okay, so with unit testing especially, I think it's not very easy to have a good testing suite. And that's what you want to rely on. And basically what I also see that if we just assume that by following the textbooks, our tests will help us, that often is not the case. So we should really look into the testing infrastructure, how in the testing suite, how do we test the things, look for a proper balance of the pyramid, of the testing pyramid. I personally believe that in many cases, the naive testing pyramid where you have most of the tests on the unit level is not the best choice, at least in the enterprise environment. My personal preference by default is the honeycomb, where you have more on the middle level tests, integration tests, because in the enterprise environment, there are lots of glue, not that much of the complicated algorithms most of the time. So it makes sense to test them on the higher level. And only when there is something really complicated, non-trivial, then you go down to the unit level. But you can also have a different approach. But the important thing is not to expect that it will be simple. It might be even more difficult than writing the production code to have a good testing suite that allows you to shows you that you are ready to go to production. And the downside of this symptom that maybe something is wrong there is when people are starting to be reluctant to write tests or reluctant to do changes because of the tests, especially if you have too many tests that are testing implementation details. If they're complaining that they're spending more time on tests than on the features, which I think also can be normal, but if people are complaining, that means that they don't see the value of that, and that might be a problem.
Very interesting signals and things to look out. And I also personally agree with you, taking things by the books without looking to our own context is meaningless, right? Because if it was that easy, we weren't having these discussions. We just take tasks lists and implement mm-hmm. them. And what will be your advice for software engineers or teams or companies that are starting the journey of testing in production?
What would be my advice for teams that are starting testing on production? That's actually a tricky one. I don't have one single piece saying, okay, this is what you need to do. I think if I have to choose one thing, I would say invest into observability and transparency of what is happening on production. And that's not necessarily related to the testing on production, but you will definitely need when you will be doing more testing on production, because more activities on production, basically, because that will decrease your risks.
Yep. Nice one. I can see that we can move from a closed system or a black box that we don't know to more knowing what's going on without having the upfront the questions. Definitely an awesome advice. And now we are getting close to the end of the episode, and my last question is your recommendations on resources, blog posts, books, podcasts, mm-hmm. trainings, mm-hmm. well, anything related to these where the audience can continue the journey.
Yes, I think I will keep it short, not to overwhelm and to focus. So we were talking about developer testing, unit testing, integration testing. And I found recently, it was in July, published a blog post, "Unit Testing is Overrated," that was resonating very well with my thoughts on that. And I share the link with you. And it's what is particularly nice about this, that it's published by a guy called Alexei Golub. And he is, as far as I remember, from Ukraine, Kyiv. That's where I am coming from. So it's very nice to have people having similar ideas. And basically, there he tries to show why over-reliance on the unit testing can be a dangerous practice. Why can it backfire?
Okay, I will make sure that these resources on the description of the episode, so people can follow that. As I said before, also your social media handlers are there, so people can engage with discussions with you. You are active in the communities, although now on in an online presence. And I want to thank you once more for your time to be here with us today.
Thank you very much. It was pleasure for me, very nice experience. Thanks.
You can follow us on Twitter at @scraftspodcast, visit our website softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn. Have a nice holiday season. See you next week.